This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Coming up, reviews of Mission Impossible 3, Confetti
Blank. MI3, I think we have to say. It's MI3, 040506. Boy, they worked hard for that release date. MI3, yeah. 04, 05, 06. Yeah. Okay. It's rubbish, but hey, somewhere there is a publicist absolutely enraptured by that.
Coming up then, movie reviews of Mission Impossible 3, Confetti, Black Sun, Love and Hate, Devil and Daniel Johnson. It all depends how much time we get, of course. Let's look at the box office top 10, which is at 10, 8 below.
Bunch of dogs survive Arctic winter. Some of them don't. Don't take the kids. They'll be distressed.
9, Take the Lead.
Sounds like it could be a follow-on from that one.
Yes, exactly. Not as good as the documentary, which I think is now out on DVD.
She's the Man, number 8.
Greatest movie ever made, isn't it?
It is, apparently.
Apparently.
If you're 12 and okay. If you're a girl, it's
there we go.
Absolutely unmissable.
I'm not going to argue with
Inside
the boss.
Man at 7.
Smart, sassy, stylish, a little bit empty, but we know that Spike Lee is going on to do more political work.
Slither at 6.
I really liked it. Great, big, gribbly, horrible, yucky bugs arrive from outer space and take over a small American town and turn everybody into walking macaroni and cheese. And if you like that kind of thing, I mean, if you like 80s horror, if you like Brian Usner, if you like Frank Henenlotter, you will get more than your money's worth. And it's a long time since a film made me go, oh, that is really yucky.
And if you've never heard of those guys,
well, get a life.
Dave on this email says, saw Slither last Saturday night. Greatly enjoyed its deliberate but stylish B-gradeness.
Yes.
But as Mark bangs on about genre movies, mm-hmm. I expected a bit more nudity. I also thought that the initial scenes of the inbred townsfolk represented them to be just as alien as the central player of the movie.
Can I just say, it's funny, nudity is the one thing that's fallen by the way in genre movies. It used to be, absolutely, there was a guy who used to write under the name of Joe Bob Briggs. Joe Bob Briggs goes to the movies, and he used to review movies entirely on the basis of gore and nudity. It was a joke. He was not a real character, but he was a joke character. But it is true that political correctness has put, and I have to say, I'm not entirely unhappy about that, the really adenoidal young boy audience out of joint slightly by the fact that it's no longer considered to be absolutely obligatory to have nude shower scenes in slug movies.
Right, so a few years ago, if they'd made Slither then...
There would have been more nudity, yes. That is an astute and well-made point.
American Dreams at 5?
It is interesting that it hasn't gone in at number 1. And again, I stand by what I said before. I think it's an adventurous comedy. It is a comedy about a suicide bomber, which probably explains why it wasn't a huge hit from the makers of American Pie.
At 4, Scary Movie 4.
Is that it now, please? Can we go?
Silent Hill at 3.
It's yet another film of a computer game, and I'm very glad to see that after my rant last week, at least the amount of emails that were passed on to me, although they may have just been not passed on, saying, stop slagging off computer games, stops a little bit. I wasn't slagging off computer games, I was slagging off movies based on computer games, which are rubbish, like this. Computer games are probably fine. Don't know, never played one, not any interest, but if that's your thing, great.
Is that how you imagine most of your critics speak?
I imagine that the ones who think that what I was doing was complaining about computer games speak like that.
Okay. 16 Blocks at 2.
Which is, fine. On the subject of B-movies and genre movies, it's an A-list star in that it has Bruce Willis and Mos Def, or as his real name is Brian Hinckley or whatever it was, Reginald Bosanquet. What is his real name?
I've forgotten.
Something
again.
Like
I'm
that.
I have to look it up.
But it's not Mos Def.
I think it's Tristan McFarquhar McNenemy. 16 Blocks, number 2. Ice Age 2, The Meltdown at number 1.
A series of entertaining animated sketches with no joining narrative thread whatsoever, symptomatic of the death of narrative cinema. But I wonder whether anybody took you up on your challenge last week, which was to go and see Ice Age 2, and as you come out, say loudly, I think it's symptomatic of the death of narrative cinema. If you did, please email us in and tell us what happened. If you can still speak, or are you, in fact, in a hospital bed after having been seen to by the crowd.
Paul in Hatfield, can you ask Dr. Kermode if there's anything currently on general release that I could take my 3 and 5-year-olds to see at the weekend? We've already done Ice Age 2, not as good as Ice Age 1, and Chicken Little, not good at all. But at 3 and 5, frankly, they didn't notice. That's kind of... 3 and 5 is difficult.
It is a difficult age.
Slither, maybe?
Yeah, Slither is great. Unfortunately, I think it is a 15 certificate. So well, unless they're on large... Did you ever used to do that thing about getting into X movies by wearing, two pairs of socks to make you look taller?
No.
Didn't you ever do that?
No.
At the Classic in Hendon? It used to work, funnily enough. So off the top of...
I never saw an X movie, anyway.
What do you mean you never saw an X movie?
They were 18s, by the
way. No, they weren't. You're making this up. You're the same age as me. They were X movies. Enter the Dragon was an X movie.
Didn't go and see it. Dante Terrell Smith is his name.
That's the
most
one.
Dev. Okay, so movies for 3 and 5 year olds, tricky. DVDs,
I mean,
probably.
DVDs are great because you can stop them, you can turn the sound down. And I warn you, even on the subject of Ice Age 2, I know you said you've already taken your kids to see Ice Age 2. I was at a screening of Ice Age 2 in which a child became completely wigged out by the moment in which one of the animals suddenly gets turned into roast chicken. I mean, it's the strangest things fire people off. And it's just, cinema is a big experience. It's just a big, moving, loud experience. And kids can be wigged out by the strangest things.
Scary Movie 4 or Slither is probably...
No, Scary Movie 4 is rubbish. Oh, and even a three-year-old would say, I'm sorry, that is symptomatic of the death of narrative
cinema. If you want to try something new, what might we try?
Mission Impossible 3 or MI3, 04, 05, 06. Directed by J.J.
Abrams.
Already
bored with that.
No, you're not. Who is apparently the director of Lost on television, which, of course, I never saw, and something called Alias.
Series 2 has just started.
Is it any
good?
So
you can... It's very good, actually.
Is it? Fine. Okay. Well, he took over from Joe Carnahan, who I think directed Narc and was originally down to do MI3. And there was all these production problems with it. And you know there's all the stuff in the tabloid about Tom Cruise was taking over everything and everything was very, very hard to get done. Different directors, blah, 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 blah. So, fine. Now we end up with the finished film, which, according to its publicity, aims for more depth than the previous two, which, frankly, is not hard. I mean, it's not hard to be deeper than Mission Impossible or Mission Impossible 2. It has the On Her Majesty's Secret Service depth riff, which is, let's give the secret agent a wife, a girlfriend and wife, who the baddie can then terrorise in a way which causes the central secret agent something approaching genuine emotional anguish. Of course, it's just a device like anything else. We've all seen it done a million times before. It doesn't mean it's real depth. It's the appearance of depth. But deliciously, in MI3, the baddie is played by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Excellent.
And here he is using some of that leverage on the newlywed Tom. You see, that kind of gives you the measure of it, in that you have Tom, okay, fine, Tom Cruise, people are very rude about him, perfectly fine, sometimes a good actor, sometimes not a good actor, maybe a bit strange in, you know, private
life.
Yeah,
but he's on with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and as we've already
exactly
proved,
there is no such thing as a bad Philip Seymour Hoffman movie, and there is nothing here to go against that rule. I've read some of the highbrow reviews today. Honestly, these people should just grow up. Mission Impossible 3 is perfectly fine, and on occasion, it's quite good. For one thing, it's nastier than one would expect, particularly for a 12A certificate movie, which, according to the grid, contains moderate action violence. Well, it starts off with a flash forward sequence which has Tom being asked for some information whilst they are holding a gun to the head of the person which then subsequently turns out to be his wife. And as far as you can tell from the opening sequence, at the very beginning, this person is then killed. It's very, very tough. You think, wow, this is going to be a grim ride. Obviously, don't trust everything you see, but this is going to be a tough, nasty movie, particularly for a 12A. It has all the explosions and gadgets that you want from a Mission Impossible movie, including the fabulous latex masks, which enable Tom Cruise to put a mask on, which turns him into Philip Seymour Hoffman. In that Scooby-Doo, I would have got away for it too if it hadn't been for you pesky MI5 agents who just happened to put a mask and a little thing on your larynx, and suddenly you're Philip Seymour Hoffman. And no one goes, you know, the difference is they're completely different shapes, completely different sizes, completely different mannerisms. But hey, if you're wearing a rubber mask, you look like the old crotchety guy who runs the ghost train who's actually doing a... I mean, fine, don't mind, Mission Impossible. They have Tom hanging on the end of bits of wire. They have Tom leaping from building to building. Oh, how he leaps. Of course, he's small, which makes it better. You know, he's more easier.
So actually, the buildings aren't that big. It's just that he's small, little, so it's quite a challenge.
That's right, yes. It's just an ordinary set. He's not actually that small. So anyway, but all that stuff is fine. The action sequences are done perfectly nicely. There is some, I think, quite unpleasant stuff about people having explosives implanted into their head, which, again, I'm surprised. I mean, when I was 12, that wouldn't have made a 12A certificate movie. That would have made what we were just talking about before, the old X-rated movie. And hey, people today, you don't know how lucky you are. On the one hand, you get all this really senseless violence and action in a 12A movie. On the other hand, please be warned, 12A, you know how it works. It means 12 and upwards. Please don't take 3-year-old kids to go and see Mission Impossible 3. Please don't take 4-year-olds. It's not for them. It's a top end of the 12A. The worst you could say about the film, and I've read some really snotty broadsheet reviews of it, the worst you could say about it is that it does absolutely go for its demographics. So you've got the cars and the devices to get the boys' audience, you've got the strong women characters, you've got the romance, which they think, oh, fine, that'll get the female audience, you've got the bit in Shanghai because, hey, the Asian audience is really, really big, you know, you've got Simon Pegg for the Brits because, hey, we've got to better give them something. So there is a little bit of box ticking, but it's Mission Impossible. It starts with that theme music. It's Mission Impossible. It goes bang. Tom runs around in black and dresses up as a priest. Philip Seymour Hoffman chews the scenery for all he's worth. And then it ends. And it's perfectly fine. It's good popcorn entertainment.
I tell a lie. The only X film I remember seeing with that X coming up at the beginning was, and I was thinking about this because Anna Massey was on the other day.
You're thinking about it because I was talking and you can listen to that. Peeping Tom.
Peeping Tom. That was an X.
Peeping Tom was an X. Peeping Tom
and
was
still isn't. Well, you know, if you get
I think it's probably now 15 on. But I may be wrong about that because it's borderline sexual violence. So I can't believe that you didn't spend your whole life going, because that's what I did. It was one of the most exciting things for me was when you'd be sitting there, somebody would be 15 and the thing would come up, this movie's been part X by Lord Harlech or whoever it was at the time. And you just think, this is great.
Andrew, on this, could you ask Mark whether there are as many shockingly bad continuity errors in MI3 as there were in MI2, specifically Mission Impossible 2, during the last action sequence? There is a motorcycle chase which ends up on a beach. I was amazed to see that the tyres on the bike change from smooth road tyres to knobbly off-road tyres instantly. Hang on.
Go on.
I would have thought that if the baddie wanted to kill the goodie, he could just have hit him over the head with a tyre iron when he stopped to change the wheel. I cannot stand the series of films personally. However, I take Dr. Kermode's recommendations. I can't wait to hear what he has to say.
There may be continuity error in Mission Impossible 3. Yeah, but exactly. Who cares? It's Mission Impossible. Wasn't looking out for them. I'm not going to go back and look out for them now. I was just more excited by the fact of things going bang really, really loudly and Philip Seymour Hoffman going hang, 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 in that evil way.
Told you before about your impressions. 85058, mayo@bbc.co.uk. More reviews to come. This email from Misha Glennie, who I imagine is the Misha Glennie who's the Balkans expert, because there can't be that many Misha Glennies. However, I might be wrong. On the subject of X movies, my mother used to make me up and stuff my boots with newspapers so I could get into X films at the local flea pit, which is the Moulin Rouge in Oxford. First one I saw was The French Connection when I was 13. At the time, the age to get into X films was 16.
That's right. It then went up to 18. Yeah.
This from Tim. I got into the cinema in Lyme Regis to see Phantasm, Certificate X, at the age of 13 by rubbing soot into my face so it would look like stubble. It worked, but the man behind the counter said, "Don't expect to see you here at the weekend for the Saturday morning film club." So I think he cottoned on to my disguise. And it did give me nightmares.
You know, yeah, that was the tagline for Phantasm was, "If this one doesn't scare you, you're already dead."
Stuart in Manchester went to see Mission Impossible 3 last night. I was disappointed with the results. The film seemed like a personal ad for Tom Cruise and wasted the talents of Philip Seymour Hoffman. The story was rushed and predictable. It seems to me that the MI franchise is solely there for Mr. Cruise's pension fund and falls way below the TV series 24.
The story was rushed and predictable. Well, the predictable bit is Tom Cruise goes into an impossible situation and comes out alive. I mean, did you not see the TV series?
Well, it might.
It's Mission Impossible. Exactly the same people that complain about basically. The only thing I didn't say about it was it's laugh out loud funny and it knows it's laugh out loud funny. And exactly the same people who didn't understand that Basic Instinct 2 knew it was funny didn't get the fact that Mission Impossible 3 knew it was funny.
So that we've only done one film. What else? If we're not going to see a big summer blockbuster, of course, it's like the first of the big summer blockbusters,
yes,
isn't it?
We're now into the summer season
officially.
We have
many more to come. What else?
Confetti, Three Weddings and a. What do you call it? A camcorder. It's kind of pseudo-documentary about a wedding competition made, apparently, in improvisation. So the actors are improvising their lines on set. Presumably they practice beforehand, before completely improvising. Three couples competing for a prize, which is set up by Confetti magazine, who have decided to do this big competition. And the couple who come up with the quirkiest wedding will win a £500,000 house. Boasts a bevy of TV stars, comedy stars. Martin Freeman, who was much better here than he was in Hitchhiker's Guide. Not that he was bad in Hitchhiker's Guide, but I thought the film had a big problem. Stephen Mangum, who's reliably slimy, who's in Green Wing, which I have to say, of the ones that I've seen, I think is fantastic. Funny, and in this particular clip, Jimmy Carr. And of course, the gimmicks that people want their weddings ruined by is one couple goes for a sort of 30s MGM style musical, another couple goes for a tennis theme wedding, and the third couple, which is I think the thing that's got the most press coverage, have a naturist wedding. There's some discussion about whether or not naturists have to be nude, but the actors very gamely do the entire role in the buff, despite the fact that the magazine want them to put clothes on, which they keep trying to explain will mean that they're not having a naturist wedding. Now, it could have gone one of two ways. There are so many British comedies in this area which just really don't gel at all. I really rather like Confetti. Its style is sort of wants to be partly The Office, partly Best in Show, the Chris Guest movie about the dog competition. Have you seen Best in Show?
I have. It's fantastic.
It is absolutely wonderful. Now, Confetti is
a very
not,
good box set with all his stuff in.
Yeah, with the Chris Guest box set. Yes, exactly. And it's Waiting for Guffman in that set as well.
Didn't notice that.
Okay, well.
Can I get back to you on that?
Get back to me on it. It's not as good as Best in Show, but very few things are. It's probably not as good as A Mighty Wind either, but very few things are. But what it is it's genuinely funny. I like the idea that the improvisation stuff... I like the idea of improvisation, but an awful lot of time, improvisation means people, you know, being self-indulgent and rubbish, and not so in this case. Now, that either means that they have done, you know, extensive rehearsal in advance, or it means that somebody did a very good job in the editing room of just getting the very best bits, and that's probably the way it's worked out. The comedy is both, you know, laugh out loud funny and also kind of quite toe curling and difficult at some points. And the most impressive thing about the movie is that despite the fact that it's laughing at all these couples, by the end of it, it's quite moving. You actually want them to have nice weddings. You want things to work. I mean, you know it's a movie, you know it's a construct and all the rest of it, but a tear was shed. I'm not pathetic. There are other people in the screening who I think felt exactly the same thing. Right at the heart of it are these wedding planners, which is this couple who are sort of like the wedding planning equivalent of Gilbert and George, who are, you know, outrageously camp, but also very, very solid and believable characters. And you really root for them. And you kind of end up wanting it all to work out all right, despite the nonsense, despite the silliness, despite the fact that at some points it doesn't quite gel. Alison Steadman is absolutely terrific as Martin Freeman. Mother-in-law, and it reminds you of her performance in things like Abigail's Party and just what a great comic actress she is. The kind of the handheld documentary style doesn't quite hold together all the way through, because there are occasions when you can't quite figure out whether it's meant to be a documentary or whether it's taking license with that form. And that's something which Spinal Tap is one of the very few films that absolutely never breaks that format at all. But you know what? As an adventurous and interesting and basically good-hearted British comedy goes, I more than got my money's worth. I laughed a lot. I did shed a tear, which I felt perfectly fine about. I got a nice, warm, pinky, cuddly, confetti-like feeling at the end of it. I thought it was a good little movie, and it deserves to do well. And if you can get that good a result out of improvisation, and believe me, improvisation is an absolute, you know, license to self-indulge, then, you know, good on them.
Ollie in Southampton, I had the misfortune of seeing Confetti fiancé in a freebie viewing thing a couple of weeks ago. It is dreadful.
It's not.
Can I finish?
Well, but, you know, it's like, what's the point? It's like saying that the North Pole is in the South. I mean, you can go on, but it's not true.
I'm trying to animate Ollie's email.
Okay.
It is yet another British comedy with absolutely no jokes. Additionally, I am a 28-year-old heterosexual man, and for the first time ever, I found the nudity all wrong. And then he repeats that. All wrong.
Yeah, well, there has already been... Somebody else was talking about this. Somebody was reviewing it. They said, you know, I felt very uncomfortable about the fact that the man's Mr. Happy was, you know, was out. Somebody said, well, I think that says more about you than it does about the nudity itself. Now, it is definitely true that in cinema, female nudity is considered to be completely normal, but male nudity is considered to be sort of largely aberrational. And in fact, one of the things that I admire, for example, Bruce Willis for, and there are many things I admire him for, is the fact that he was a mainstream star and Richard Gere, incidentally, who did not mind being au naturel in front of the camera. And I think that's a good thing, because I think it's completely wrong that actresses are expected to get their clothes off at every opportunity, but men, no, of course they can keep their pants on. I mean, where's the justice in that? It's nonsense.
It's the way Hollywood always ran.
Yeah, well, it's wrong and it should be sorted out. More male nudity in mainstream movies, please.
You're moving into your homoerotic phase again.
I'm not moving into it. I'm enjoying it. I'm living in it. I've built, you know, a sofa and surround system in it. You know how I feel about the Richard Gere issue and all the rest of it. The fact is that underneath, everyone knows this is true. It's just a lot of people are too uptight about it.
James, on the subject of X-movies, in my town... which is Felixstowe, if you're interested, he says, it might have been a crime, but it was also the national sport. About, you know, this is getting into X-movies when you weren't supposed to. Off the top of my head, he said, we managed to gain access to Alien, The Omen, Dress to Kill, Death Race 2000, and there are many others.
That's an education.
I have to say to Dr. Professor Lord Kermode that we didn't have to wear extra socks. A slightly deep voice seemed to do the trick. And that girl selling tickets never, but never looked at you as she sold you the magic piece of paper.
That's right.
God bless apathy, says James. I've loved horror ever since.
Yeah, you see. And I do think that a whole generation have slightly been robbed by the removal of the X certificate, because there was just, you know, Dracula Has Risen from the Grave is never going to look as good when it's cert 15. X is what you need at the beginning of a horror movie.
It is. 13 to 4, Louise has the lead. What was it with about the letter X?
It's everything. It's absolutely everything.
But why did they come up with, why was it X rated?
Well, I assume that what it was it was to do with, you know, G being general and A being adult, and then X meaning, it'll be to do with, like, not general. It'll be like, you know, outside of general. But you're right, it's bizarre. I don't know. I'm flannelling.
Right,
if somebody knows what it is.
I spotted that.
Yes, I know. But of course, the worst thing is that now it has other connotations. Because in America, X originally was things like Midnight Cowboy was X. That was an X-rated movie. And then, of course, Deep Throat came along and X became porno. But of course, when we were here in England, X just meant grown-up adult movies. That's, you know, proper movies. And if somebody knows why they chose that, I can't believe that I don't know this, but I don't. I think it means, as in, exempt from the general thing, but it's just the look of it. It looks like somebody slashed an X on the screen, you know.
The rather splendidly named Frame Muller says, my mother used to make me sit on a pillow in the back seat of the car when we saw X films in the drive-ins in South Africa.
Oh.
Most notably, Arnie's Running Man and Total Recall. They were never X's in the rest.
Was it an 18? Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Well, maybe it was an X in South Africa.
But South Africa has got quite stringent film censorship.
Going to see an X with your mother,
I know,
really does not appeal.
No, it doesn't.
That's not what it's there for.
No.
This says, can't the Beep stump up another 100 quid and get Mark on for the whole programme? It never seems as though we've heard all he has to say, and blimey, does he have a lot to say. This 100 quid wouldn't get him for the rest of the programme. And frankly, I don't want to hear him on the sports panel, because he hasn't got a lot to contribute.
Your loss.
Ollie is back on this. My problem with Confetti's nudity was with hers, not his.
Oh, well, in that case, I take back everything that I just said. What? No, hang about. What's he...
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Nick in Stanmore, my first X-rated movie was The Manchurian Candidate, the original, and the best. I was taken by a friend of my mother's on his motorbike, and that was another first for me. I don't want to go and see an X with a friend of your mother's either, really.
But on a motorbike's cool.
Yeah, that's pretty good. By the way, just a reminder that Once in a Lifetime is our next First In for free screening. It's on Sunday the 14th of May. So that's Sunday week. It's a football documentary, so Mark glazes over at this point. However, it's supposed to be very good. It's about the rise and fall of the New York Cosmos, the team that brought Pelé to America. And if you want to see it, these are the locations: Belfast, Birmingham, Cardiff, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Greenwich, Manchester, Nottingham, Sheffield and London. You call 08700 100 500. You ask for option 4, or you can go to the website. All the details are there. What else is new?
Let's do two documentaries. Black Sun, which is a very limited release, but a very effective and affecting documentary about Hugh de Montalembert, who's an artist who in the 1970s was mugged in his home, had paint stripper thrown in his eyes, lost his sight. Far from doing what you might be expected in the circumstances, he made a fairly stunning life recovery and went out on his own, now, you know, newly blind, traveling around the world, discovering that his brain continued to produce the most awe-inspiring images. And what he concludes is that, I'm paraphrasing him, but he says that sight is not a perception, it is a creation. And he, in the course of this documentary, which is directed and produced by music by a guy called Gary Tarn. Now, I think, and I may be wrong, I think Gary Tarn went to my school, and if it is the same guy, he was a very, very talented musician at school, and this would make sense because he provides the musical score for the film. It's a series of images, which is photography done from around the places that the artist went to, but all processed to look like sort of strange, surreal visions. Also, and then the whole thing is narrated by the artist himself telling his own story in the first person. It's obviously an interview which has been edited together, and he's got an extraordinary voice, and he tells this extraordinary story about how his life was completely changed, and yet how he continued to be this great visionary artist. And it's very hard to describe, but it is, in the end, that most difficult of things, and that most impossible things. It is a film about blindness, and I thought it was really adventurous and really well done. It, like I said, it's on limited release. If you get a chance to see it, Black Sun, well worth checking out. Slightly less limited release, The Devil and Daniel Johnston. Now, I should confess right at the beginning, you probably had heard of it.
You haven't seen it?
No, I've seen the film. Of course, right. I've seen the film. What do you think this is? A tabloid newspaper? Have I ever reviewed a film that I haven't seen?
No, you haven't.
Thank you. Moving on, Your Honour. The Devil and Daniel Johnston. I get abusive mail sometimes when we do the top ten. I say I haven't seen that because I was off last week. But I'm sorry, but now I have gone back and seen it. And stopped the rant. Fine. Had you heard of Daniel Johnston?
No.
You hadn't? It's not just me, then. He is a cult musician.
Oh, that Daniel Johnson.
Yeah, no?
No.
Fine. In that case, I feel less stupid. Daniel Johnson, for those who don't know, this is a Sundance Award-winning documentary about Daniel Johnson, who's an oddball misfit who has ongoing mental problems and has been in and out of asylums and has recorded a string of home-recorded albums of the most peculiar music. Has developed... imagine Jonathan Richmond times about 98. You know, remember Jonathan Richmond?
Indeed, I do, yes.
Fine, okay. Well, I'm a big fan of Jonathan Richmond, but he is about as far as I go on the Is He Having Us On scale. So... this guy achieved local notoriety first, and then after Kurt Cobain wore a T-shirt, a Hi, How Are You T-shirt, which is the name of one of his unfinished albums, became a huge international celebrity. And here is, because you have to hear this to understand, I'm really glad that you hadn't heard of him either, because I did think it was just me. Now, believe me, that is the high end of what he does. I mean,
what do you mean by high end?
I mean, basically, it's less professional than that for most of the stuff. He obsessively recorded everything, including conversations, arguments with his manager. He even recorded himself getting arrested in the Empire State Building for doing graffiti on the walls, because one of the things that he is a comic artist. He draws comics, you know, passionately. And the documentary that this reminded me of, I mean, people have compared it to, for example, there was a documentary, there have been many documentaries about Brian Wilson. There was one recently about Arthur Killer Kane, you know, the mad genius. This actually reminded me of Crumb. Remember the Crumb documentary, which was a beautifully produced piece of work. Terry Zwigoff directed it. And of course, It did deal with the genuine sadness and the genuine catastrophe of mental illness alongside the sort of the brilliantness of invention. And now, there's that old Spinal Tap thing, which I always quote about. There's a very thin line between clever and stupid. And in terms of music, there's a very thin line between mad and genius. And I really can't tell you whether I would ever sit down and listen to a Daniel Johnson LP. I mean, it is almost unlistenable in some ways, but it is completely raw and completely strange. The best thing is that the documentary worked for me. I'd never heard of the guy. I don't think I'll ever go out and buy any of his records, but I found the documentary absolutely fascinating. It was helped by his extraordinary archive of tapes. There are modern-day interviews with his closest friends and colleagues and his parents, who appear to be latter-day saints, quite frankly. And it's loads of sort of, you know, Super 8 footage from when he was a child. I mean, all that stuff that to some extent you've seen before, but put together with a real passion and a real care and a real commitment to getting across what Daniel Johnson is about. Like I said, at the end of it, you may not ever want to listen to a Daniel Johnson record, although many people, including Tom Waits, I didn't realize this, have covered his material. And he is a huge cult figure, although I am thrilled to see that you were as much in the dark about as I was. But believe me, Devlin Daniel Johnson, there's one lovely moment in which he says, you know what I really want? I want the Beatles to reform and be my backing band. And you think, on the one hand, that is the maddest thing anyone could say, but hey, if you're going to aim high, aim high.
Nick in Glasgow, having watched The Devil and Daniel Johnson at the Glasgow Film Festival a couple of months ago, one of about 15 films I watched during the festival, I was relieved to find that I wasn't the only person at the screening who was staggered by it. It was the only screening I've ever been to which not a single person stood up to leave until the screen had gone blank.
Very good.
If you don't recommend it this week, I'm afraid I won't be able to listen to your learned exegesis ever again.
Film of the week. I mean, it is clearly film of the week. I really, really liked it. And like I said, that's from somebody who knew nothing about the subject beforehand.
On the subject of X movies. Mm-hmm. My auntie took me, says this text, my auntie took me to see Emmanuel.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking it was Emmanuel, as in God with us.
Oh, really? Right.
Shortest piece of film I've ever seen. You can just imagine the scene. Better stay anonymous, as she might be listening. That's one sheltered granny, isn't it? Nanny. A crash helmet under your arm at the age of 13 got you into Confessions of a Window Cleaner in Leamington Spa.
Yeah.
Says Mick.
Yes, that would work.
Laurie in Brighton.
God bless British sex comedies.
Laurie says, I do wish, big fan of the show, blah, blah, blah. I do wish Mark would stop describing movies, especially thrillers, as edgy. This is a meaningless term, telling us nothing about whatever film it describes, and Mark, usually so precise in his criticism, should know better than to use it.
Sounds like a valid point, and I will strive not to say edgy again.
Ben in Cambridge, just to correct Mark, you said that, talking about the North Pole being in the South, just to correct Mark, here the North go. Pole is
in the South.
Is the pole towards which the north pole of the magnetic pointer in a compass points. Since, unlike poles attract, what we consider as the north pole is in fact the Earth's south pole. So one could in fact be right in saying the north pole is in the south.
You see, as I said, all criticism is subjective, and it turns out that all scientific fact is subjective as well. Let's get on to the penguins and how the fish got out of the water.
So, movie of the week?
Well, The Devil and Daniel Johnston.
And for everyone else?
Well, go and see Mission Impossible 3. It's good fun. Confetti is really good, jolly British comedy, despite what some of the listeners think. But Devil and Daniel Johnson is a good film.
Check out the downloads on the 5Live website. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you Monday at 1 o'clock. Drive is next.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.